after a good 8-10 hours, if you have animals in that home, they will eat you. Cats will eat you, but so will little dogs. It's unfortunate, but when they're stuck in that house and you're not breathing, I think they smell an odor. They might start needing licking you to see why you're not responding, and then that turns into them just eating you. And it's unbelievable. They can remove your head and go down into your chest, and it's just something that most people shouldn't see in a lifetime.
Every raindrop reflecting on the water as the sun shuts her eyes. Don't know why you'll uncover. Watch the tide rolling with the moonlight. Everything is silent on this Louisiana night.
Sitting with us today is Mr. Toby Savoie. He is a death investigator with over 18 years experience, so a veteran in the field. Welcome, Toby.
Good morning. Thank you.
I have to ask you, how did you get started in this? And I know you're going to have to explain, what's the difference between a death investigator and a coroner?
Sure. So I started in healthcare really young. In high school, I was taking a nursing aid class. I thought I could maybe bathe the women, but I got stuck with mannequins and all my friends took shop. I have a lot of people in my family in healthcare. So when I graduated from high school, I continued my studies and went into some other ancillary types of medicine and respiratory therapy and then other things. So I got into healthcare at a really young age and then continued my studies and schooling and ended up in respiratory therapy for a long time. That job involved seeing a lot of trauma and being in the ER when people from accidents would come in or arrive in the ER. That kind of piqued my curiosity. And what exactly do police and paramedics see? And what do people look like when they're not on a stretcher or white sheets in an emergency room? I've always had somewhat of a morbid curiosity to see what we didn't see in the hospital. And again, I've been in healthcare for 30 years and I've been in the role of a death investigator for 18 plus now. So that's kind of how it all started. And that's where I am today. I just really feel like I could get out and get on a podcast and maybe talk about some of the preventable causes of death, and just some of the random things we see, and maybe help people that need to be helped or need to hear something so they can avoid a possible accident or any type of trauma.
Yeah, absolutely. And you get called out so many different kinds of scenes. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So we start seeing a lot of homicides at the end of summer. People, I think the heat and the stress of the heat can tip people overboard. And then summertime is also when we see our decomposed bodies. So it's probably the most trying time on a death investigator like myself, because here in Louisiana, the weather's hot and humid, and it doesn't take long for active decay and bloating and all of those things to take effect on a body. So it's really tough on us. When fall and winter come around, that goes to more natural deaths. I think the weather changes affect a lot of people, especially your elderly geriatric population. We get a lot of natural deaths at that time, whether it's heart disease or kidney disease or just sudden heart attacks. When Thanksgiving and Christmas roll around, we have a lot of, here in Louisiana, we have a lot of people drinking and going to parties and on the road and distracted and busy with work. A lot of accidents happen in the wintertime, and we see some of the most heart-wrenching cases is closer to the holidays. That might be a family losing all their children or, you know, something to that effect that just brings you to your knees.
You mentioned pre-show a lot about what your work is, really preventative death, because you're in that position to have so much knowledge about ways that people can be safe.
I've seen so many accidental deaths, from seasoned farmers driving a four-wheeler on a levee to kids just riding circles in their yard. These machines flip and it can crush their spine really fast. So we see deaths. And I remember a case where I had three children that were riding on a four-wheeler and it flipped and killed all three of those children. Babies is another area that I often tell young parents about. You know, we don't have an overwhelming amount of infant deaths and crib deaths, but when we do, they're always in the same manner. It's if you use baby products, if you put a baby in a baby bed with baby blankets, you're less likely to lose that child. We were all raised. I slept with my children. They slept in the bed with us. We put them sleeping on an adult-sized king mattress because they couldn't roll. Or maybe you set them on the couch, or the babysitter puts them on the couch while they go and do dishes. And the babies will have what's called positional asphyxia, so their airway will kink.
Can I ask you a question? I've heard that SIDS is sort of the catch-all for cases where babies die, even in situations where it looks kind of like the blanket smothered them, they fell in the cracks. Sometimes we call it sudden infant death to kind of protect the parents from knowing that they sort of messed up. Is that a real thing or is that a myth?
I don't ever use SIDS anymore. I mean, I'll even tell parents sometimes that, you know, we used to call things SIDS, but now we truly know that it's positional asphyxia. And look, it can still happen when you're doing everything right. I've had fathers sleeping with their baby in their arms and just fell asleep and the baby's airway kinked. Sometimes they have acid reflux and they're laying in bed, in the right bed with the right blanket, and acid reflux can set in and cause an airway obstruction. So, I mean, there are natural circumstances that can happen with babies, but more often than not, the babies are in a cluttered baby bed with adult blankets. Babies are on the couch or on a chair sleeping. They wedge. They're sleeping between mom and dad, and you know, one of them rolls on the child, or the support surface of the area they're sleeping on is too soft, so they can't readjust their airway, their head and neck, in the event they need to. So, you know, just telling parents to use the, you know, baby products, baby beds, and things like that really, really goes a long way and saves lives.
In the process of your work, do you ever use tools like equivocal death profiling or psychological autopsies? I teach a class on serial killer investigation, and we do a week of equivocal death profiling. So I was just going to use it for my own purposes.
No, I mean, look, our homicides here are 99% of them are cut and dry. You know, subject was gunshot wound, shot by another child or adult. And, you know, there's footage of that, or it's witnesses. And law enforcement does a great job when there's some of the gun violence that we're seeing that starting to happen every day now. But, you know, unsolved homicides here are very rare, at least in our area. And again, hats off to law enforcement. We do have deaths where maybe the son kills the mother or the father kills the son. And in those circumstances, we can figure out what happened pretty easily. We do have random homicides, though. A friend of mine, day after Christmas, was walked to his truck and turned his truck on and forgot his keys inside. Forgot his wallet. He went back in to grab his wallet. And when he came out at, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning, there was somebody stealing his truck, and they shot him in the stomach or they shot him in the chest, and they fled the scene. It might have taken a couple of months, but law enforcement eventually found the people that did that to him. So that's, you know, your typical homicides, though, are pretty easy to track here. So we don't have many unsolved homicides that I can think of.
What's your process for reading scenes? What kind of external details are you looking for? And how do you determine things like time of death? And you mentioned that homicides are more cut and dry in this area. What are the scenes that are like a little bit harder to ascertain what happened?
So suicides can be tricky. I mean, all of them can be. You have to really read the scene from the minute you get there. I mean, the minute I'm stepping out in my car, I'm looking at everything around me, where they live, how they live, what neighbors and friends are there, who's on the scene, what law enforcement agencies work in the scene, who are they talking to? First thing we do is on a scene like a homicide or a suicide is we're going to go in there and look at that body to see it's in its natural state. So first thing we're going to do is walk in and look at that body and look for anything that doesn't make sense. We're speaking to the detectives. They're giving us the information that they have about the subject and whatever history there is about that subject. And then from there, we'll move around the home and look for things like suicide notes or weapons or drugs and abuse and things laying around. And we'll eventually speak to the family, talking to whomever discovered that subject and how did they discover them. And, you know, we're reading everything from what they're telling us to the stories they give to the stories they told. I mean, and we work closely with everybody at one scene. The most important thing we can do is if we feel that there was foul play, the sooner we secure that subject in a body bag, the better, because we don't want the body to lose evidence. So we literally put everything in that body bag that's laying around that subject. It might be sheets or a pillow or a jacket or a book sack. And sometimes we'll put all that and seal it into a body bag. So that can be sent off for autopsy for a more thorough evaluation. Everything matters on scenes. Sometimes a big help now is social media. We could see maybe this person was sick and complaining of being sick, or maybe they were depressed, or people comment. People often get on social media and talk about how bad they feel. Maybe they were saying their chest was hurting or their back was hurting. They had leg pain. And some of that can lead us to different medical diagnoses that may not be foul play. So we use, you know, even cell phones. You can see, you know, who was the last person they spoke to? What were they texting people? Were they depressed? Were they happy? Were they joking? I mean, that can determine, you know, accidental versus intentional. So everything around the scene is very important as we're processing.
Wow. And that's so much more than I think the average person thinks that you would do when you arrive at a scene. I'm curious, I don't know if you've been following what's happening in Austin at all, Lady Bird Lake. They've had some suspicious drownings with men kind of in the bar area on Rainy Street. A lot of men have been found that have drowned maybe after they went out. I'm curious to know, have you had any instances where drownings weren't necessarily drownings on paper? And if that were your thought, what would you be looking for?
Well, so I did read an article about that, and they had a high volume of deaths in a short period of time. And sometimes that's just coincidental. I mean, you might have three or four people that drowned and others had heart attacks, and it all happens in that one area. I can tell you, in our area, I had one school was affected for at least a two-year period. They lost six or seven children, and it was just all coincidental and heartbreaking. So things can happen like that that make it look like there's foul play when there truly is a reason for every death. When we work a drowning, a lot of the evidence, of course, can be removed because of the water. When that body's in the water for a long time, it sinks and then it bloats, and then different animals like turtles and other things can nip at it and make it really hard to read. But the one thing that we can do is tap the lungs for fluid to see if they drown. Is there fluid in their lungs? So oftentimes when we have a drowning, we can rule out whether this person might have had a heart attack or a drug OD versus fell into the water while still breathing by the fluid we can take out of their lungs. So we can determine. I've had several older men working outside who happen to have ponds. They simply just slipped into their pond. Did they drown or did they have a heart attack? So I draw their fluid in their lungs. There's no fluid. And he has an extensive, you know, heart history. Well, he's working out in the yard at 80 years old, and he's exerting himself with, 10% of his heart left, and he falls over into a pond. I can tell that he died before he went into the water. So when we're looking at drownings, we have different things we can do to find out if they actually drowned or not. And if we ever question anything, we can always send an autopsy for a more forensic review.
And then speaking of the drowning, I don't know if this is correct or not, but a lot of the fentanyl OD patients present some of the symptoms as drowning victims. Is that true in autopsy?
They do stop breathing. I mean, obviously, but no, I haven't heard that one. There's so many fentanyl deaths. Now, fentanyl, and when we see fentanyl in an autopsy, it's usually, you know, they're doing toxicology on the subject. Most of our ODs do not go to autopsy, but I will say that one drug that really affects an autopsy is methamphetamine or crystal meth. When someone abuses meth, their organs and their bodies age so rapidly. You can have a 30-year-old who did crystal meth for a year, and his heart and lungs and liver look like that of an 85-year-old chain-smoking, unhealthy diabetic patient. You know, the chemicals that they're putting in that stuff just wreak havoc on the internal organs. We'll see that often with methamphetamine.
I have a question about fentanyl. Are you seeing the landscape of drug consumption changing with the introduction of fentanyl? I ask that just because, you know, we've noticed in the news, we see there was the high profile case of that out-of-state guy who came into town and was found rolled up in the carpet. And then there were a few other cases where there were people found rolled up in a carpet and autopsy says they OD'd from fentanyl. And that just isn't usually how we find our ODs, at least in my perspective. So I'm just wondering if the way fentanyl is being consumed or how deadly is it changing the landscape of the way it looks for drug consumption?
So what's happening there when you find somebody rolled up? And I've had a handful of those cases, whether it's a shower curtain or a piece of the rug or even a sleeping bag, and maybe they were thrown over a bridge and, you know, or dumped into a bayou. And what that is people just removing the body from wherever they OD'd at. So instead of just carrying a body limp, it's easier just to roll them in something that can, you know, hold their body while they dispose of them. But that's what you're going to see. Now, we don't have an overwhelming amount of those. Most people die fentanyl, or I mean, they die everywhere on fentanyl and Walmart in their car, in their homes. It's just a sudden cardiopulmonary respiratory failure, and they drop or they don't wake up. And when we walk into an OD, we can tell by the aspiration. Most of them have aspiration, which is, you know, vomit and food and things in their airways. And then, of course, we see other signs of drug abuse. Normally, there's straws and or syringes or needles, or they have a severe history of it. You know, and then, you know, when you're talking to the family, I mean, sometimes you get to an OD and there are no drugs on scene, and they were there with friends or, you know, family. And I'll often ask, well, who found it? And a lot of times families get nervous because the police are coming. So they'll remove all the drugs from that scene. It's important. Sometimes it's challenging to get it out of the family. You have a good idea this person was doing drugs, but they don't want to tell you that because they're scared of law enforcement. So oftentimes I'll I'll sit with someone alone away from law enforcement, and I'll explain to him, listen, I'm medical. I'm not law enforcement. I don't care what he was doing. I'm just trying to figure out what caused him to die. And I've never had someone not open up and say, yeah, he was using the synthetic drugs bought at gas stations, or, you know, he had a fentanyl problem or a Xanax problem. So we can get it out of people, but there's so many now that, I mean, it's every day we're seeing people die from fentanyl, and the pills they're getting, you can't tell. I can bring two tablets to a veteran pharmacist with 50 years experience, and he can't tell me which of those oxycodones are real versus fake. I mean, some of them are, some of them you can tell, but others, they're just becoming better and better at it. And same goes for Adderall. They're putting crystal meth and Adderall for, you know, college kids, and all your Xanax and your Valiums are being pressed into pills. And that, of course, contains fentanyl. We're seeing cocaine with fentanyl in it. Every drug you can imagine is laced with something. So it's really scary. And we're seeing so much of it, from high school kids to, you know, people in their late 70s and all in between. Drugs is one of the areas that I like to talk about, because it's so important. You have young kids experimenting in college, and you have older folks who truly have pain. And they'll do anything when it comes to pain control or just drugs in general. Many of them have polydrug abuse, meaning they take benzodiazepines with opiates and alcohol, and that's a deathly concoction. So just getting the word out on all the dangers of drugs today, because the cartels are working against us, and there's a lot of dangerous things out there. I mean, just go to a gas station and look around. They have all types of substances that kids can buy, and with TN-Aptine is one that's kind of new here, and they call it Zaza. And it's an antidepressant. So people are taking handfuls of antidepressants to get an opioid-like effect from it. And they can't come off of this medication. And when you start changing the brain biology, things can happen. Depression, suicide, or they're just under the influence and swerve off the road and kill you. So, you know, Adderall, which is a fake Adderall that is sold in gas stations. I think we need to do a better job at regulating what people can buy in gas stations and things like that, because kids are buying it. And you just don't know what they're putting in this stuff. All the precursors are coming from overseas, and they're not looking out for your health. So again, drugs is a big area. Fentanyl's just terrible right now. It really keeps us busy, and we see a lot of people losing family. It's just tough to see all around.
Is it just that it's so potent and it's so present that it's an easy thing to use, and it's accidentally easy to kill people with it?
Absolutely. The majority of ODs are accidental overdoses. Whether they're doing a synthetic drug that's smoked and they have a seizure and die, or they're taking fentanyl. What's bad is a lot of people that had problems with opiates turn to heroin. And then fentanyl's cheap, so they're putting fentanyl in everything. And most users are building tolerances. So it's not that their drug dealer wants to kill them, and the cartels don't really care, because it's such an addictive substance. When people have it, they just want more and more of it. And this isn't being made professionally in a lab. It's being made in a bathtub. So the doses that they're putting in these pills are fatal. They're putting fatal doses in different drugs. So it's not really intentional murders. It's more of an accidental. And they're adding even more things to fentanyl now. Now there's xylazine, which is a veterinarian tranquilizer. Mm-hmm. And so they're mixing that with fentanyl to make it that much stronger. When someone dies in a neighborhood on an OD, you'd think most people, you know, want to find out, hey, where'd you get those drugs? Because I don't want any of them. Well, the friends and other junkies that want that medication. They want that stronger drug. So they go out and seek it when somebody dies. They're chasing the dragon. They have such a tolerance that they're not even noticing the effects of highly potent fentanyl. They want the strongest batch they can find. And it's really sad what happens to them. And there's also crystal meth. And there's a lot of crystal meth here. And it's also very cheap. And, you know, that drug turns people into monsters. It changes their psychopathology. They stay up for days. They don't sleep. And they're either really high or really low. So they're either very aggressive or very depressed, and all in between, delusional, you name it. Sometimes crystal meth has fentanyl in it, if you can imagine the upper and the lower effect on the body. So it's really bad. Fentanyl and meth are the leading two, and heroin.
Could you tell us a little bit about any trends you've seen regarding gun deaths over time?
Yeah, guns are out of control right now. So what I'm seeing, at least in our area, is Caucasian people are dying of accidental drug overdoses, and African Americans are dying by the hand of gun violence. And it's really sad, because it's children, ages 13 to even into young adults and older adults. But the majority are children, ages 13 to, I'd say, 25. And they just shoot each other. They don't know, they don't have any fear of jail. It's not even necessarily always about drugs. They might be trading video games. And the one kid wants that video game, so he just shoots the guy with it. Maybe he's buying a gun, doesn't plan on paying for it, so he shoots him. Social media. Maybe one of them called the other one out on social media, and he'll just walk up to him and shoot him. So it's really, really sad what's going on with guns. We see it a lot. And in fact, Opelousas, St. Landry Parish, is the number one area of homicides per capita in Louisiana this year. It's really out of control.
As somebody in your position, what do you think we need to do to start making our state safer?
The more education we have at a state level, the better, in my opinion. Yeah, I drive around Texas and I'll see a lot of signs on fentanyl, a lot of billboards and a lot of education. We are getting better at educating people. But the other day I was at a convenience store and an ambulance passed by and a little guy working said, "What do you do?" And I told him, you know, I work for the coroner's office. And he said, "Oh, what do you think that ambulance is?" And I said, "I don't know. If they don't call me, then they should be okay." And he said, what are people my age dying of? And I looked at him and I said, fentanyl. And he couldn't even pronounce it. He's like, "What is," he tried to say that word. And I thought to myself, kids in their 20s should know that instantly. I think we could do a better job at educating the One Pill Can Kill campaign, you know, talking to kids in schools and really pushing for support. A lot of these kids that are shooting other kids are coming from broken homes, or maybe they don't have family. Some of them are even raising themselves. And it's really sad. So communities can come together as well as at a state level. And we see it. Law enforcement, chiefs of police are doing more community organized events with kids, and tip of the hat to them, because it makes these kids, it gives them something to do and it gives them somebody to look up to.
I can't imagine all of the things that you've seen over your career. What's your process for decompressing from some of these things?
So for me, music is my go-to. I listen to music, all sorts of music. I have a very diverse collection of music, but it gets me out of the different moods I'm in, depending on what type of scene I'm leaving. I'll play different kinds of music. It just, I don't know, it's my escape for me. I'm also listening to podcasts. Just gets your mind off of what you just dealt with. You know, that can be the hardest part. We, you know, we all have families and people we love, and sometimes we have to pronounce our friends and people that we know and very close friends. And that can be really hard. And we don't always know the people we're pronouncing, but you know, some of the things we see and smell and take home with us really can take a toll on us. And you can have really strange, vivid dreams and nightmares, all sorts of things. So everybody in any high stress position needs some form of an escape.
And you mentioned something really interesting, Toby. You said that in your line of work, a lot of times you refer families to crime scene cleaners or other services. But you said the Cajun folks here, they take care of their own. Is that because it's very expensive, or do you think there's something else there?
Well, this is Louisiana. We just take care of our own people. So if there's a bad accident in a home, let's say there's a suicide, you're always going to have some family members that are going to come around and help. I'm not saying don't use. Sometimes you don't have a choice and they have to use a professional crime scene cleaner. Those guys do a great job. And there's several of them around. But in smaller cases, there's always family willing to help. And that's a Louisiana thing. We treat our friends like family and our family like friends. And no one's scared to go out there and help. You know, we have suicides and sometimes there's parts of their face and their curtains are on their couch or on their ceiling. And I'll see a lot of families pull together and straighten all that up before that spouse or that person needs to go back into their home.
Wow.
Something about Louisiana, it's got a whole lot of problems, but it tends to lure us back, even when we try to leave.
Absolutely.
You recently did another high-profile podcast, The Theo Von Show, and you mentioned that our pets have a short window for when we go, a short window to...
How fast do we become food?
Yes. How fast do we become food?
Yeah, I misspoke on that podcast. I think I said, you know, in an hour or so. But I would say after a good 8-10 hours, if you have animals in that home, they will eat you. And everyone's really pushing the cat thing. And it's true. Cats will eat you. But so will little dogs. It's unfortunate. But when they're stuck in that house and you're not breathing, I think they smell an odor. They might start even licking you to see why you're not responding. And then that turns into them just eating you. And it's unbelievable. They can remove your head and go down into your chest. And it's just something that most people shouldn't see in a lifetime. But it happens. They're animals. They're hungry. They're locked in the house. You know, get a cat door. Get a dog door. Can't hurt. It'd give them somewhere to go. But it's unfortunate, but it happens. And cats and dogs, but not so much labs. Bigger dogs, I don't find do that.
That's good to know. Yeah. Is there pack animals, maybe?
I don't know. Get a lab.
Yeah.
I'm looking over at my dog right now, suspiciously. Yeah.
Good dog. We were talking about suicide earlier. Mm-hmm. With fentanyl even, or heroin, all these young people on heroin will often find people in bathtubs. And, you know, one thing we use, or one thing we know, is that women won't commit suicide nude. So when we find a nude woman in a bathtub, with maybe a history of drug abuse or even in a bed. I mean, women just don't want people to see them nude, even after death. So those are some of the clues that, you know, or the things that we know to look at when we're working some of the suspicious or questionable suicide versus homicide cases.
I wouldn't have thought of that. That's really interesting.
Yeah. You know, women protect their bodies even after the fact.
Everyone always mentions death has a very specific smell. I've heard one woman describe it as strawberry milkshakes mixed with garlic. Do you have a characterization for how it smells to you?
Well, it smells really bad, and it's a smell you'll never forget. It's more of it's a meat with a fruit scent. So there's a sweet odor, but it's a very loud, rotten meat odor. And like I said, you can smell it from a mile away. And when you do smell it, you won't forget it. It's not easy to deal with. You know, we can wear masks. There are certain things that some people put in their nose to try to block the smell. But when you're working on a crime scene and it's a suicide versus homicide, you have to spend a lot of time with that body and in that home. And the smell is tough, but you have to give that subject justice.
And you said you sometimes go into people's fridges. You're really like attuned to their environment when you're trying to make a cumulative kind of analysis.
Absolutely. That's the first thing I look at.
So I bet Cajun people have some interesting things in their fridge.
You'd be amazed what people eat, but you can really tell how someone lives by what's in their fridge. I mean, when it's just pizza and fried chicken and beans with a spoon in it and a lot of alcohol versus, you know, fruits and vegetables. I mean, it really tells you, was this person living a healthy lifestyle? And we, you know, I mentioned on another podcast that there was a hogshead in a fridge once. And you don't open a fridge expecting to see a face staring right back at you. So that one caught me off guard. But you can tell how someone lives by their surroundings. I mean, do they smoke? Do they eat unhealthy? Do they drink alcohol? All of those things can be evident the minute you walk in a house. And it helps us paint that picture.
So I'm really interested in how you determine the time of death because it seems so complicated.
So when we get a call from the police and they're on scene, let's say you have an 80-year-old who the spouse found in bed, cold to the touch. We immediately issue a time of death. And that's basically just when they contact us. More importantly, we use things like rigor mortis. It takes a few hours for rigor mortis to set in or start. And then it actually resides, you know, in about 36 hours. So that, you know, depending on the body's decomposure, that can tell us how long they've been down. There's also things like lividity, where the blood starts pooling. When the heart stops, all the blood drops to the surface. And that can tell us, you know, if that body's been moved or not and how long that body's been down. So, we also use, again, when was the last time you spoke to your brother? You know, when was the last time he made a phone call on his phone or maybe uploaded something to Facebook? All those different things, and including witnesses, when was the last time you saw him? All those things matter when we're trying to figure out a time of death. Time of deaths are very important in homicide cases because it can put people in different places. That's why you hear law enforcement saying, you know, where were you when this event happened? So the closer we can get to time of death, the better. But, you know, we use all sorts of different methods to try to get as close to it as we can.
And I have to ask, have you ever had a body after the fact? I know with all the nerve endings that sometimes there's a Lazarus effect. Has that ever happened to you?
No, I've never had a body do anything remotely like that.
That's good.
Yeah. No, when we get there, I mean, they're deceased. You know, we do all kinds of, you know, different exams on the body. And some of that is toxicology. So we're drawing blood or visual fluid to run toxicology. And we do a lot specifically for tox and DNA. In some cases, we'll have to get DNA.
Wow.
You know, maybe we have a decomposed body and there might be an ID in the same room as that person. But that person is so severely decomposed, you know, the family can have a hard time accepting those remains without proof. And so in that case, you know, we have to do DNA samples. And it's not always easy when they're decomposed. You can have a degradation of that sample. You can't just rub a Q-tip in their mouth. You may have to remove teeth. You may have to pull off a piece of their liver or even remove a toenail or even the toe. And you get that to a lab and you still have to swab people in their family if they have family living, you know, mom, dad, or even two of them. But, you know, those are some important things that we have to do in that circumstance to that body.
But you'd be an interesting person to probably pull over with everything you got in your cooler going off to the lab.
No doubt. You might find blood or a toe or a body part in my core. Helps get us out of speeding tickets.
Wow. I feel like I've learned so much today. I'm so fascinated by what you do and other people like you. I don't think they get nearly enough credit for what you're doing for our community and for people at large. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity to get out here and just talk about some of the things we see. Thank you all.
If you like what you hear, go subscribe to Missing Magnolias Now, wherever you get your podcast.